Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Michael Bordo of Rutgers University. Michael and I met in London on the weekend of the ash cloud in April 2010, where he was speaking at a conference on lessons from the Great Depression for the making of economic policy. He began by outlining the story of his paper, The Banking Panics in the United States in the 1930s, some lessons for today.
So the sort of consensus view of economic historians is that the Great Depression from 1929 to 39 had the first phase was the Great Contraction from 29 to 33, and that it had a lot to do with monetary forces. Friedman and Schwartz, in their famous book, talk about one-third collapse in the money supply. And what drove most of that decline in money was a series of banking panics from 1930 to 33, banking panics which involved failures of thousands of banks, which involved people, you know, sort of trying to get their money out of the banks and to, you know, hoard as much currency as they could. And this happened in part because the Fed, which was established to deal with banking panics, which had been a really, really big problem before 1914, and to act as a lender of last resort and to provide liquidity to the banking system. The Fed didn't do this. And there's many stories why. It had a lot to do with the false doctrines they followed, the real bills doctrine, and also the sort of inadequacies of the structure of the Federal Reserve System, sort of a dichotomy between the powers of the Board of Governors in Washington and the Reserve Banks. But the banking panics were crucial in that story to what happened. And it's not just Friedman and Schwartz that said this. Ben Bernanke, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, emphasized the banking panics. And the way they worked was by disrupting the operation of credit allocation. So they were really crucial, the crucial part of the 1929 to 33 story. Well, now, how does that compare to today? Well, we didn't have a Friedman and Schwartz banking panic story. Why? Because we have deposit insurance. Okay, why? Because the Fed, in a sense, has learned to be a lender of last resort, and other central banks, like the Bank of England, always knew it. So we didn't have a 29-33 banking panic, but we did have a panic. It was a panic in the shadow banking system, which was unregulated, which involved the repo market, which is the way in which the universal banks and investment banks and other types of financial institutions fund themselves. And it was caused by the subprime mortgage crisis and the inability to price or understand the underlying value of the securities once housing prices started to fall. And it had many of the hallmarks of the 1930s. I mean, you had these interbank runs. Well, in the 30s, you had a run that worked through the correspondent banking system. But it was not, it didn't affect money supply. Money supply actually went up. So in that sense, it's different. But there were liquidity elements to the first few months in 2007. And the Fed and the other central banks dealt with it with aggressive policy in 2007. But what they didn't do was keep going in 2008. They sort of sat on their hands, worrying about a run-up in commodity prices. And so the financial crisis sort of started to morph into a serious recession. The peak of it all was the failure of Lehman Brothers in September. That led to a full-fledged panic, interbank panic again, and inter-financial institutions panic, not the public running on the banks. And at that point, the Federal Reserve and other central banks did the right thing. They engaged in massive monetary easing. They reduced the policy rates to zero. They started purchasing open market purchases of non-traditional assets once they hit the zero nominal band. And that, I think, got us out of it. Okay, that ended the crisis, and it also got us out of the recession. So those are the kinds of lessons we get. But the other lesson that I want to make is that we, By bailing out too big to fail or too interconnected to fail, non-bank institutions, investment banks, and also the universal banks, that the bailouts that came about starting in September 2000, that really has created a whole set of problems which were not present in the United States in the 1930s. Some of it was present in Germany in 1931 because they had large universal banks. And I have a paper with Harold James which discusses why there was some there was some relevance for that. But generally, the too-big-to-fail doctrine is the biggest bad legacy that's come out of this crisis. And it'll be very interesting to see if we really deal with it. I'm kind of pessimistic that we really will deal with it.
So in general, Mike, you have a kind of a mixed view. You think that the policy lessons learned from the Great Depression and were implemented by policymakers today were positive in terms of saving us from a far worse recession or depression that we could have had. But on the other hand, there's created these problems further down the road for future potential
crises. That's right. But what I would like to say, I mean, as an economic historian, I like to caution everything by saying no one did the counterfactual. What would have happened if the Fed and others hadn't done what they did? And there were other things that were being held constant, e.g., we have automatic stabilizers, e.g., we have deposit insurance, we have a different structure of the banking system and the financial system, and the real economy is much more diversified. So, you know, even if nothing had been done, okay, I don't know if we would have, I doubt very much we would have had the Great Depression, but things would have been worse. So we have to always throw that caveat in.
Can we talk about potential remedies for protecting us against future financial crisis, banking panics of this kind in the future?
I mean, I mentioned in my talk, I talked about the one sort of view, which I think has been expressed here by Mervyn King, is that you just don't let banks become big enough to fail. You cap their growth. And I think that you know, that idea might work. Or you go the route that Kotlikoff suggested. You create these narrow banks and you somehow or other turn the rest of the non-banking system into a mutual fund. Okay, I think that, you know, maybe it would work, but I think that in a sense the political economy that we have in these countries wouldn't allow it to come about. Okay, and we'd have financial regulation which would undo it. The second remedy is go back to Glass-Steagall. You separate investment from commercial banking, or you do the Volcker Plan where you sort of restrict what commercial banks can do. Anybody getting access to the safety net should not be allowed to engage in proprietary trading. And here we raise these questions of, you know, did Glass-Steagall really work? Did they really need it? And why did it end? It ended in part because of financial innovation and political pressure, and I think all those forces would come back again. The third possibility I suggested, which in many ways is my favorite, but they will not adopt, even think of it in the States, is go the Canadian route or the Scottish-Canadian banking route. You have very sound banking. You have to, in a sense, restrict entry, which means you're in some sense creating a cartel, which is anti-competitive, but you have regulations and you have all these constraints on what banks can do, and you get sound banking. The U.S. isn't going to ever buy anything like that. They're just not going to allow anything which sort of smacks of restricting competition. I mentioned a sort of libertarian approach, which is you just say, okay, we're going to protect the payment system. We're going to protect deposits in small banks, and that's it. And the rest is sovkipuk. People will learn how to self-insure as we did in the 19th century. Maybe we'll regulate pension funds. Maybe we'll regulate the life insurance business. But we'll really have a very hands-off approach and let the market work things out and decide who's going to be saved and who isn't, and people would act to protect themselves. Okay. Again, that's not going to fly. That's the political concept of it would just get people absolutely mad. So, you know, I came up with all these solutions. I talk about the debate in the U.S. about what to do, and I think that you can make arguments for cutting back on some of the Fed powers. You don't need them really to do consumer regulation. They don't really need to regulate supervise and regulate small banks. It's not clear they need to be handling systemically too big to fail banks, but maybe. But I think that these are the debates that are going on in Congress, and they involve these, you know, political economy turf wars, and we'll see what happens. Or something very simple, my sort of basic list of what you really need to do. You come up with sort of counter-cyclical capital controls, capital requirements like they did in Spain. You put derivatives, you make them trade on transparent markets with clearing houses. You impose some limits on leverage, and that's about it. And I think that those kinds of things, they did those, would probably be enough. And if they don't do all this stuff, we'll wait for the next crisis.
But I mean, is a lot of the problem that now the markets are so global that it's very hard for one country, even as big as the US, to...
Right, it has to be, everything has to be done internationally. You have to have cooperation on this. But even so, everything the BIS has done in the past with Basel I, Basel II, it's all been undermined. It's not clear that this isn't going to lead to another crisis. And in a sense, what we learned is we know how to deal with crises. We didn't turn into the Great Depression. Okay, and the next crisis won't lead to the Great Depression either. And so people have to learn to insure themselves against financial crises, which are part of they're part of the landscape. The history of financial crises, as I've looked at, you know, as Reinhardt and Rogoff have looked at, I mean, it's part of the economy. It's part of economics.
Final question, Mike, perhaps on a more positive note. I mean, this is a great time for economic historians, isn't it? We're really having to look back in the history books to see what we can learn.
It's great. It's been great for me. But the thing is, you know, I've always studied monetary history, and whether it's the monetary standard, gold standard versus fiat, whether it's financial crisis, what type of banking system, I mean, there's always been an interest. If you do stuff that's policy relevant and you can make it interesting to people, then there will be interest. And I think economic historians have to learn that what they do, if they want to have it of interest beyond their fellow historians, is to make it relevant.
Michael Porter, thank you very much.